All right, good evening, Saints.
Good evening.
Let's go ahead and we'll pick her up here. All right, so we've been talking about the hydroplate theory as an explanation for the flood of Noah's day. It is, in my opinion, probably the best explanation for it. There are others out there. And I'm going to do, actually, I just got another book on the particular idea, and I'm going to read through that one and see how it matches up. But I think this is probably the best explanation for the flood of all the material that I've covered. And it seems to make the most sense and answer the most questions and helps the puzzle to fit together. So far, we've introduced the subject of the flood, and there are four major phases in the flood. The first one was the rupture. That was the result of supercritical water and tidal pumping. Once the rupture started, of course, then the flood ensues. During the flood phase, that's when much of the earth would have been covered with not only water, of course, but also with a tremendous amount of sedimentation. The third phase was the continental drift phase, in which the continents were settling into their current position. And then, of course, we are in the final phase, which is recovery. That has been going on since, really, the end of the continental drift phase. And being a part of that recovery phase, being in that recovery phase, we continue to see things that lend itself to pointing out that we are in the recovery phase. Things like, well, changing climates, melting ice caps, things like that. So what I wanted to talk about tonight, is what is the subject's called Earth Roll. So remember one of the, I just gotta get my mouse over there so it actually advances. So one of the things that had happened at the end of the continental drift phase, at the beginning of the recovery phase, would have been that mountains were pushed up. And plateaus would have risen up out of the continents as the rest of the continents had settled. If you remember that photo that I showed you of the Canadian Rockies of the folded mountains? You don't get that by folding brittle rock, you get that by folding soft layers. So the mountains would have sprung up relatively quickly after or during the initial portions of the recovery phase and at the end of the continental drift phase. So one of the things that had happened, and I kind of used this example last week, is if you take a bowling ball and there's no holes in it or anything and you spin it, it'll pretty much spin wherever it can find an equilibrium point. And it's in a bowling ball, if it's made well, you can spin it in a lot of different directions, and it'll probably stay relatively stationary. Now, you take that same bowling ball, and you, say, cut a good chunk out of one side of it, and then spin it, it's going to spin, and then it's going to level itself out and find an equilibrium point where the weight around the equator of the bowling ball is as even as possible. And it will stay in that particular position. Well, because of this dramatic formation and relatively quick formation of mountains, it would have caused the earth to slowly roll 35 to 47 degrees. This is a pretty substantial shift in the earth's axis. There's a gentleman by the name of Dodwell that discovered that there had been a pretty significant shift in the earth's rotation from studying almost 100 ancient astronomical measurements made over the last 4,000 years. One of the interesting things is that the astronomical measurements show a progression. It wasn't an immediate shift. A good portion of it was pretty immediate. But over time, as the Earth was continuing to level out, that shift continued to happen. And so that's one of the things that we're able to show actually did, or provide some proof that these things actually did happen. So one of the things that had happened during this time, of course, is that with the shifting of these, with the shifting of the Earth and in the changing of its axis, the pre-flood North Pole then, it has moved, or it did move, into what is now Central Asia, or it moved from what is now Central Asia, and it eventually moved into its current position. Okay? So, if you look at it here, you have the on the left in illustration A, You have where the old equator was, and then there was a shift, a change in weight. And because of that, you can see where the mountains are kind of pointing out there, that little point there. It kind of gives you the idea of where the mass change was. As a result of the mass change, of course, the heavier portions of the mass would have shifted, causing the North Pole to shift as well, and overall changing the main line of the equator. So because of this, a couple of other things here, just as a couple of illustrations, just give you a pretty good idea of, you know, the physics behind how that would shift. The North Pole shifting on the Earth's axis would have had a significant impact on, obviously, the climate of that area. This begins to explain, I'll just skip that one. So this begins to explain why we find coal, dinosaur fossils, mammoth remains, all kinds of other critters that don't live in a cold Arctic climate, why we find remains of them north of the Arctic Circle and near the South Pole as well, in areas where they should not be living. These dinosaur fossils that we find are not, you know, I don't know if you've ever noticed, but you don't see a lot of lizards running around in the cold. They're cold-blooded, right? So when we find these dinosaur fossils in areas that just don't, it doesn't make sense, this helps to explain that. Mammoth remains are an excellent example of that. Most of those are found in the Siberian region north of the Arctic Circle. And as I talked about a little bit last week, mammoths weren't designed by God to dwell in cold climates. Their fur just, it wasn't good at keeping in heat. It was more about radiating heat. And then, of course, the remains have often been found with tropical plants, undigested, still in their mouths, and in some cases in their stomachs. So all these temperate latitudes where these animals lived were, well, they were temperate before the flood, but after the flood, when the earth rotated, well, guess what? They had been shifted into an area that was no longer temperate. So the direction and the magnitude of the roll are also shown by some of the other animals and plants that today live at specific temperate latitudes, but whose fossils are found inside the Arctic Circle as well. So we see things like some of the examples of some of those fossils that we find, things like horses, bears, beavers, badgers, shrews, wolverines, rabbits, considerable temperate vegetation. All of these things are found on Canada's Ellesmere Island, which is inside the Arctic Circle. But those animals don't live there today. But their fossils are found inside that area. These animals require a much warmer temperature, at least 18 degrees warmer in the summer and 27 degrees warmer in the winter, in order for them to live in those particular areas. Also found are other remains of large lizards, constrictor snakes, tortoises, alligators, tapirs, flying lemurs. Now found, the flying lemur specifically found only in Southeast Asia. And all of these fossils are found north of the Arctic Circle. So there had to have been a pretty major change in the Earth's orientation in order for these things to have happened. Some other interesting information here is that when they had done some studies of the cellulose and redwood trees on Axel Heiberg Island, it was just west of Ellesmere Island. Both of them, again, are north of the Arctic Circle, and I'll show you that picture. So there, that yellow line at the bottom is the Arctic Circle, and then Ellesmere Island is right here. Kind of gives you an idea where it's at. The studies of the redwood trees on these two islands show that they grew in a climate similar to that of today's coastal forests of Oregon, which is, of course, 35 degrees farther south in latitude than where they're found on this island. Ellesmere Island and Axel Heiberg Island have the largest known contrast between current temperatures and inferred ancient temperatures based on their fossils. So in other words, the fossils that they find there do not belong there according to an old Earth mentality and an evolutionary mentality. And their average temperature throughout the day now, or throughout the year now, is much, much, much too low for the critters that they find there, for the fossilized remains. So the pre-flood North Pole, it rolled south near 95 east longitude, while the region presently occupied by today's North Pole rolled north near 85 degrees west longitude. So also implied is a roll of at least 35 total degrees. Physics and geology, when we look at the evidence from physics and geology, it gives a similar picture. Whether it's because the fossils aren't the only reason we can make this particular guess or arrive at this particular conclusion, physics and geology also help us to be able to make this assumption. So, some other interesting non-scientific, specific-based information is that there's some historical records. They tell of a catastrophic flood and an apparent earth roll. One of the, probably the most famous and one of the oldest is called the Epic of Gilgamesh. Ever heard of that? Okay. If you get a chance, and I know it's not generally what you would call light reading, but it is interesting. It's prose. When you get a chance, just Google it and read it. And boy, it'll sound awful familiar to a particular story that you've heard out of the book of Genesis. Okay. Another one was put together by a linguist of the name of Charles Berlitz. He reported that early Jesuit missionaries in China located a 4,320-volume work, it's a fairly substantial work, compiled by imperial edict and containing all knowledge. So, 4,320 volumes of information collected in that time frame, that's quite a bit of knowledge and probably all they had at the time. But it states something rather interesting. It says, the earth was shaken to its foundations. The sky sank lower toward the north. The sun, moon, and stars changed their motions. The earth fell to pieces, and the waters in its bosom rushed upward with violence and overflowed the earth. Man had rebelled against the high gods, and the system of the universe was in disorder. Sounds remarkably familiar to what we've been talking about. So, this earth roll was kind of one of the major shifts and one of the reasons why we continue to see melting glaciers, melting polar ice caps, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not going to get into all the greeny stuff because, well, I don't believe in it. Anyway, so let's move on a little bit here. We're going to talk about inland lakes and canyons. So during the recovery phase, drainage of the water that had covered the continents had left every one of the basins within the continents filled to the brim with water. It's not difficult to imagine, especially as of late with the flooding that we've had, whether it's in the last couple of weeks or last year. But if you flood an area with water, with a large amount of water, and then that extra water is essentially leaves, anything that's low will be filled with water. Now, I'll give you an example. My backyard, we have gotten so much rain, my backyard is saturated. So when it rains, it doesn't go anywhere. It doesn't soak into the ground anymore because it's saturated, and there are literally puddles in my backyard. Well, the next time it rains really hard, my lawn kind of floods. And then as the water starts to eventually seep away, there's still all these puddles. Same thing would have happened on the earth. And every one of these continental basins would have been absolutely filled to the brim, left over from the initial flooding. So some of these post-flood lakes would have lost more water by evaporation and seepage than they had gained by rainfall. And of course, drainage from higher elevations would not have necessarily come into all of them. So there are areas where there would have been large amounts of trapped water that eventually would have evaporated. And they would have left some evidence of their particular existence. And of course, they would have shrunk over the centuries. Great example of that is Lake Bonneville, which is part of the Great Salt Lake. And I don't know if you've paid attention to that, probably not, unless it piques your interest, is that the Salt Lake is drying out. And it's a big deal, because there's a whole lot of people in that valley that depend on it. Okay, but Lake Bonneville is a great example. It is part of an area called the Great Salt Lake. So here's a quick drawing of it there. You can see in the darker blue section in the center, that is the Great Salt Lake area. And then you have the Great Salt Lake Desert to the east and to the south. And then if you kind of go up north, you get into the border of Idaho, kind of see the outline of Lake Bonneville there. Lake Bonneville is an interesting area because it is one of the flattest, most level places on Earth. And it's primarily salt. Okay? At its largest, this particular Great Salt Lake, that's outlined in the whole blue section there, it would have covered nearly 20,000 square miles. That is a very large area. I mean, you look at the map, you can tell that is the state of Utah. That's a pretty significant chunk of the state of Utah. It was about 325 miles long, 135 miles wide, and had a maximum depth of over 1,000 feet. Now remember, this water would have been primarily salt water, trapped in an inland basin. And of course, it is now home to the Bonneville Salt Flats. So other lakes would have gained more water than they lost. So we're looking at Lake Bonneville, and we're looking at Great Salt Lake. They evaporated away. There weren't any higher elevation lakes to drain into them. Well, other lakes would have gained more water than they lost. This would have had a significantly different effect. As they would have gained more water, whether through rainfall or other higher elevation lakes draining into them, the water would have eventually overflowed the rim of those lakes. You ever build a sandcastle? Whether, you know, I didn't live near the ocean. I lived near Baker Lake, and we had sand. And you could build sand, and we didn't have waves unless a boat drove by. And then you were lucky because it had to get really close. But we'd build sandcastles, and of course, you'd fill up your little, you know, moat around the sandcastle with water. And, you know, you'd build a little rim around it, you know, the edge of your moat, right? Well, if the water found a spot where it could start to get over the edge of that, it would begin to break away very quickly. It wouldn't just trickle. The pressure and the motion of erosion would make a very large gap, and the water would pour out relatively quickly. Well, you have a number of post-flood lakes that would have been trapped in these particular areas, and eventually as that water overflowed the lake's rim at the lowest point in the rim, the resulting erosion at that point on the rim, it would have allowed more water to flow out, so that erosion would have occurred relatively quickly. And of course, it would have down cut in the side of that rim on the lake very, very quickly and very catastrophically. Eventually, the water would have overcome the pressure of the rim and rushed out. Okay? So, as the water was cutting deeper and deeper and causing much more water, it would have cut faster and faster. And so this rapid, catastrophic cutting of the Earth's surface would have created something that we call a canyon. Now, I don't know if you've ever thought about it, but if you're up, you go up north of town, not very far, up onto the rims, and you look south, what do you see? You see on the South Hills, and you have the rims on the north. We live in a valley that was carved very quickly, and it wasn't carved over billions of years by the little Yellowstone River down here. It was carved very quickly when there was a large release of water, and it carved out this canyon. If you ever get the chance, go out to Four Dances National Recreation Area, I think is what it's called, or Natural Preserve Area. It's out on the east end of town, on the rims there, just overlooking the river. If you get a chance, there's a relatively steep path down the side of those cliffs. It's really cool. The path down isn't so bad. It's the path back up that's not so much fun. But what you'll see is that those walls are nearly 100% vertical, and a lot of them have, over the years, of course, have roughened, but they're very smooth because they were eroded very, very quickly. It didn't take the millions of years that the evolutionists would claim. So they would have formed these inland lakes, breaching their dams, would have formed what we call a canyon today. And of course, as this water would have escaped from these higher lakes, the escaping waters would have flowed into lower basins and filled up those basins. And then those basins would have eventually overflowed, and they would have created another canyon. Now, it's difficult to imagine how the massive size of this particular process. There weren't that many people around to witness it, by the way. You know, only a few. About eight. Well, maybe a few more by then, but the Grand Canyon would have been an excellent example of this creation that would have resulted from these flooding basins. The Grand Canyon was definitely formed in this particular manner. Oh, there we go. Primarily by the dumping of what was called Grand Lake. So when we talk about canyon formation, one of the most common answers to canyon formation is the river that is left in the bottom, or the creek that is left in the bottom, when it's actually the opposite. The river that is in the bottom of a canyon is generally the leftover of the flood. The river certainly did not cause it in most situations. If you've ever watched a video on Mount St. Helens, it does a terrific job of explaining how quickly a canyon with very fine layering can be created. It's over the course of just a few days. And the flooding at Mount St. Helens after the eruption, and then after the settling, and then there was a subsequent eruption, it formed a mini Grand Canyon with exceptionally fine layers of stratification. Well, you remove that particular canyon out of the Mount St. Helens area and you put it somewhere else where they don't know how it happened, their assumption is going to be that it took billions, trillions of years, millions at least, to form that particular canyon, when we know it happened very quickly. So with thousands of inland lakes that were left over after the flood and a lowered sea level, there would have been a lot of other canyons that had been formed. Now, some of those canyons are now covered by the ocean. A couple of examples. The Strait of Gibraltar, the area under the Golden Gate Bridge, and the Bosporus and the Dardanelles. A couple of interesting examples there. So the Strait of Gibraltar is down there at the southern tip of Spain and the northern tip of Morocco. I don't know if you can see. Where did my mouse go? Well, there it is. So the Strait of Gibraltar is a good example. Would have had some inland lakes that one had breached, forming the strait. Here's another one here, San Francisco, and the Golden Gate Bridge goes right across here. You can see there's a large lake. It probably would have been much larger pre-breaching of the dam. And then, of course, you have the Dardanelles, and you have the Black Sea, Sea of Marmara. So, all kinds of interesting geologic and geographic anomalies that we can explain on the basis of a worldwide flood. So the next one we want to talk about is the Grand Canyon. I'll talk real briefly about this, but the origin of the Grand Canyon is rather interesting. Geologists admit that they don't know how the Grand Canyon was formed. Interestingly enough, I have a book that I bought for the fossil museum, and I bought it at a fossil museum, at a creation fossil museum, and it's basically about the Grand Canyon and how it formed. It's awesome. It talks about how it was formed really, really quickly. And for years, up until about 10 years ago or so, it was actually sold at the Grand Canyon Visitor Center. Until somebody read the book that didn't agree with it, and then they reported it, and then, of course, now it's not sold in the Grand Canyon Visitor Center anymore. Because it, you know, actually tells people the truth, but that's a whole other story. But here's the interesting thing is that they all agree on one thing, that the Colorado River somehow carved it, and remove the evidence. I haven't been to Red Lodge since the flood, so I don't know. Well, I guess we had been there. We were there for skiing. A little different, you know, when it's covered in snow. But you definitely see evidence of a flood. I mean, there's still evidence throughout town, from what I understand, of a flood. And that's a relatively small-scale flood. Something large enough to carve the Grand Canyon would leave some evidence if it had happened the way that they say it does or did. So for over 150 years, this particular process or this particular idea of that the Colorado River had carved the Grand Canyon has resulted in the canyon's birth or creation being a hazy mystery cloaked in intrigue and filled with enigmatic puzzles. That's literally a quote from a geology textbook. And the reason for it is because they have too many pieces that don't fit into their particular narrative. And so when the pieces don't fit into the narrative, you adjust your narrative, right? No, you stick with it and just say that these things are enigmatic, hazy, and cloaked in intrigue, instead of allowing the evidence to speak for itself. Overall, there are 8 main proposals for the Grand Canyon's origin that are rejected by almost all experts. I'm not going to outline any of those in this particular class, but each one is described in detail in Dr. Brown's book. What we will consider, though, are 2 ancient post-flood lakes, Grand Lake and Hopi Lake. Grand Lake and Hopi Lake successively breached their boundaries and carved the Grand Canyon in just a few weeks. This explanation not only unravels the confusion, but it solves other puzzles that had not previously been associated with the Grand Canyon. Remember, I talked about Occam's razor, when you can find the theory that most simply answers the most number of questions, it's probably the right answer. This is an excellent example of this. So we're going to just look at a couple of these, but I'm not going to go through all of them, but any satisfactory explanation for the origin of the Grand Canyon should be able to explain the following evidence requiring an explanation. There's just a few on the side there, things like layering, side canyons, perpendicular faults, the inner gorges, the Nankoweap Canyon is actually pretty interesting, some very unusual erosion. I mean, the layering of the Grand Canyon is spectacular. So any theory that explains how that layering was laid down and then wiped out so quickly has got to also be able to answer a number of the other features that I've listed there on the screen. There's marbled canyons. This is the Black Canyon of the Gunnison. I had shown you this before. Those trees at the top are mature trees, 60 to 100 feet tall. So that's a very, very tall vertical cliff with melted rock that's been injected into the cracks. Some other items, things like forces, the energy, the mechanisms, missing rivers, the Kaibab Plateau, missing dirt, the fossils, tipped layers, and then, of course, the question of whether it's time or intensity that created the Grand Canyon. Here's just a real brief overview of, like, the Nankoweap Canyon, for instance. I have a lot more information on this in my regular class, but for the sake of brevity, the Nankoweap Canyon would have come about as the result of a very rapid and violent multi-directional flow of water. It would have carved Nankoweap Canyon and its other side canyon, so it's a main canyon, then it has other canyons that come off of it. And it created a large delta that still remains today despite the cross-flowing Colorado River. There's a large delta deposited during the flood in the Nankoweap Canyon, and the Colorado River flows right through it, and that delta still exists. And then, of course, it also stacked boulders 100 to 200 feet high along the Nankoweap Creek, and humans lived in it for a very long time. There's actually an interesting settlement. I believe you can hike to this particular area. Those are man-made structures, just in case you were wondering. They lived in the area, and the evidence, the archaeological evidence from the area, shows that they grew a considerable amount of grain crops. that require a significant amount of water. One of them being corn. And then all of a sudden, they left. Well, why? Well, there's some pretty good answers for it, actually. How about forces, energy, and mechanisms? Yes. Oh. Yes, Larry.
So the guys that lived in the caves there on the cliff, mm-hmm. where did they grow the corn?
That down in the valley.
Down in the valley. Okay, mm-hmm. thanks.
Yep. And then also the other areas are up on the... No, that's a good question. They grew a lot of it down in the valleys. And then I'll go back to that picture real quick. Too far. Yeah, no, I can't get back. There it is. Okay, so if you look at... Well, it's difficult because I don't have the photo. But up on the top side of that, where the dwellings are, up on the top side, there's a large plateau. It's all desert now. But they would have grown it up there as well because there would have been a water source. Yeah. You can hike to it today from what I understand. Unless you have a significant fear of heights, and then it's probably not a good idea. But so just a quick side view of the Grand Canyon. There's many layers of rock there. Some pretty interesting things. There's something called the Great Unconformity. You'll see it at the base of the Grand Canyon down here, this Great Unconformity here. This is a layer of rock that surrounds the earth. You can find it everywhere on the earth. And you know what you don't find at that layer and below? Ever? Fossils. All the fossils are found above the Great Unconformity. So basically what you're looking at is what's called basement rock. That's early crust. That's pre-flood crust that you're looking at there. And then everything above it was deposited afterwards. Every explanation for the Grand Canyon requires lifting the Colorado Plateau, then lifting it more than a mile in the air, and moving massive amounts of water and rocks. So the question becomes, are the forces, energy, and mechanisms for these movements known, or are they merely inferred or assumed? See, it's easy when you take a particular subject like this, the Grand Canyon, it's a very large geographic feature, and it's easy to explain one component apart from all the others. But when you look at the area as a whole, it becomes very difficult to explain it with modern theory. So without a knowledge of the underlying physics, which must conform to scientific laws, by the way, major errors are going to creep in if you start to ignore components of a larger system. Even if the influences or assumptions are found to be correct, ignorance of the actual forces, energy, and mechanisms will blind us to the root causes. It'll blind us to the rates at which they happened. It'll blind us to other consequences. Modeling and testing becomes limited if we're not willing to look at other pieces of evidence that help support our particular hypothesis. Well, when you start to look at these explanations for the Grand Canyon, most of them at best are half-baked. They just don't make sense. Or they ignore a significant amount of evidence. Another one is the Kaibab Plateau. If you've ever looked at the Grand... How many of you have ever been to the Grand Canyon? I know you guys have been. I've never been there. I want to get there someday. But the north rim of the Grand Canyon is at a significantly higher elevation than the south rim of the Grand Canyon. The last time I checked, water flowed downhill. Right? Okay, unless you go to the Cosmos and the Black Hills or whatever. It still flows downhill. But here's the problem. If the north rim of the Grand Canyon is 1,000 feet higher on average than the south rim of the Grand Canyon, then the water should have flown from the north to the south. But the water flows east to west. And by the way, made a 90-degree turn in solid rock. And then flowed across a sloped plain to form the Grand Canyon. Okay. The Grand Canyon and the Kaibab Plateau are an excellent example of not being able to adequately answer some of the geologic features with the Colorado River. How about the missing Mesozoic rock? What swept off a soft Mesozoic layer at least 1,000 foot thick from atop 10,000 square miles of limestone? So 10,000 square miles of earth, 1,000 feet thick was swept away. Well, where'd it go? Where did so much of that dirt go? It would be about 800 cubic miles of material being removed during the carving of the Grand Canyon through and below the Kaibab limestone. The Colorado River's delta, it doesn't even contain 1% of that missing material. So again, the Colorado River does not provide an adequate explanation for the creation of the Grand Canyon. And then, of course, I mentioned as well that I think it's really interesting that you don't find any fossils below the Great Unconformity. They're all above. Okay. All right. So, as I mentioned earlier, we want to talk about two ancient lakes, post-flood lakes, the Grand Lake and Hopi Lake. These would have successively breached their boundaries and carved the marble in the Grand Canyon in a matter of weeks. This explanation, it not only unravels the confusion, but it solves the other puzzles that weren't previously associated with the Grand Canyon, as I'd mentioned. Now, I normally go through a tremendous amount of detail in this, but of course these lakes don't exist anymore today, but the remains of them are very clearly seen. If you ever get a chance, go on Google Earth and just look at the Four Corners area between Colorado, New Mexico, Utah, and Arizona. It's the Four Corners area. Just look at a topographical map, if nothing else, and you'll see the outlines of these lakes. Now, is this particular rendering perfect to the foot in the GPS coordinates? Probably not. But it gives you a good idea of where that water was. So, in summary, Grand Lake, that was standing at an elevation, that's that northern lake there, that was standing at an elevation of 5,700 feet above today's sea level, it would have eroded quickly its natural dam 22 miles southwest southwest of what is now Page, Arizona. So in doing so, the northwestern boundary of the former Hopi Lake, whose elevation was 5,950, so 250 feet higher, was eroded, releasing waters that occupied the present valley of the Little Colorado River. It occupied the southeast quarter of Utah, parts of northeastern Arizona, as well as small parts of Colorado and New Mexico. So here's just a quick drawing of it. You can see where the Grand Canyon and the Marble Canyon starts here, and then you have the Grand Canyon out to the west there. Yes, sir?
Do seculars, scientists, whatever, do they admit that Grand Lake and Hopi Lake existed at one time?
Yes and no. They do admit that there was a lake there, but they don't think it was that big. Yeah, because if it was that big, the water would have to go somewhere. And the Hopi Lake is another one that they're a little skeptical on. And if you do any research, one of the things that comes up, of course, is the Bonneville Salt Flats. And it's not widely accepted, at least not in the old Earth scientist perspective.
If you go there, you can see the big indentation where it was.
Yeah. Just look on Google Earth, and that's a pretty large area to go there. But yes, you can look on Google Earth and see the indentation. Look at a topographical map. There's other canyons, canyon parks in that area. There's other national parks in that area. Places like Zion National Park is a good example. You have petrified forest that's in there, there's all kinds of interesting features in this particular area. So. Here's a kind of a snapshot from a relief map. So there's your Grand Lake and Hopi Lake. There's the Marble Canyon, the Kaibab Plateau, this area that's higher in elevation than the southern area. And that's where it makes a 90-degree turn across a slanted plain or a slope to carve out the canyon. So this brings us to what's called the funnel. So imagine Grand Lake, post-flood lake, 5,700 feet above today's sea level, with the area of the and volume of Lake Michigan, 1,180 cubic miles of water, by the way, in Lake Michigan, which would cover approximately 22,300 square miles, high on the Colorado Plateau. So you have this Grand Lake sitting on a high Colorado Plateau, and about 15 to 20 miles beyond the southwest shore of Grand Lake is the top of what is called the Echo Vermilion Cliff System. Despite losses from evaporation, which of course would have happened, the water would have eventually breached its dam. As water drains from under the Grand Lake, it emerges as springs from the face of a 2,000-foot cliff system that had been created as it's losing water. So increasingly, as this water leaves this area, Grand Lake's breach would have created a gigantic spillway that is called the funnel. So, as the ground sinks along the path between the lake and the cliff, it would have formed many of the other features found in some of the Barb Canyons. You go to some of the Barb Canyons and they have actually bent layers of sedimentation where the ground would have sunk around it, and other areas where it would have been tunnels that would have collapsed. So a tremendous amount of erosion would have happened in this particular area. So eventually, Grand Lake would have breached its bank and catastrophically eroded across the Kaibab Plateau, eroding all that soft Mesozoic sediments, creating a gigantic spillway, which is a steep 18-mile-long channel that is shaped like a widening funnel. So you have the Echo Vermilion Cliff System, the Vermilion Cliffs here, you can see where north is, and the Echo Cliffs. And you can see it on either side. This is easy to see on Google Earth or on Google Maps. It looks like a big funnel. Okay? So as the funnel would have been created, the water, the escaping water's volume, and the high velocity would have eroded the far end of the funnel within weeks to a width of about 12 miles and a depth of about 2,000 feet. Here's a picture of it from the sky. This would have helped. This helps explain Marble Canyon. The originally horizontal sedimentary layers below the floor of the funnel would have steadily arched upward as weight is removed by its downward erosion. Remember when we talked about this? When you remove a massive amount of topsoil from an area, the ground buckles up. Let's go back one slide here or two. That area is sloped upward because all of that earth would have been removed. The crust would have buckled up underneath of it, and what remains is the Colorado River. So eventually, the funnel's floor, that hard, brittle Kaibab limestone, would have cracked, forming the Marble Canyon, and then, of course, where the Colorado River is. And then the aquifers that would have been underground would have been severed by the crack, and they would have spilled into that newly formed canyon. Again, here's another photo. Okay. Eventually, as that formed, and as the aquifers, that was porous, water-saturated rock, cut by these deep vertical cracks, began to rapidly spill their waters, and then subsurface channels would have drained into Marble Canyon, and they would have begun to form other canyons, these side canyons and barb canyons. One of the interesting things here is that the red indicates the direction of the flow of the Colorado River. The yellow indicates the direction of flow from water that created the canyons. If the Colorado River is flowing this way and formed all these canyons, why does the direction of the sedimentary layers show that the water came from up higher and went down? It doesn't make sense. Okay, so a couple of other things. Here's a photo from within Marble Canyon. Pretty cool. So, oops, did I go back? I did. Here we go. So the Grand Canyon would have been formed by that south-flowing torrent of water that had been released from Grand and Hopi Lakes. Remember, Grand Lake undercuts the northwestern corner of Hopi Lake, whose elevation was about 250 feet higher, and it would have released its waters as well. Their combined waters, now sweeping westward, would have begun to create the Grand Canyon. It would have first removed at least 1,000 feet of soft sediments above the hard Kaibab limestone. And then at this particular point, almost 10,000 square miles is of earth is south and west of the funnel is removed. All the weight is removed. And then the deeper sedimentary layers would have arched upward, stretching and in many places cracking open the hard, brittle Kaibab limestone above. So near the breach point in Hopi Lake, a gigantic waterfall forms. And then Hopi Falls removes so much weight that the Kaibab Plateau forms. So it's an explanation of where the Kaibab Plateau comes from. And then, of course, the escaping water from both lakes continues to flow westward, continuing to carve out the Grand Canyon. So you have Grand Lake here at the opening of the funnel. It kind of starts right about there in today. And then you have Hopi Lake over here. Grand Lake, as it comes this way, it erodes the western edge of Hopi Lake, and then all of this water, approximately 250 feet higher, changes the direction of the flow, and then it flows westward across Arizona, and the Kaibab Plateau would have risen out of that particular area because of all the sedimentary layers having been removed. So just another little wider picture for you. Couple of other. This is a photo from Google Earth, so you can see on Google Earth the funnel right up in here. So there's your Vermilion Cliffs, and these are the Echo Cliffs. Then you have the Kaibab Plateau right up in here. Okay, so almost or about 20% of the volume of the rapidly rising Kaibab Plateau is subsurface water. Landslides, slumps, and mud flows would have continued to spill down the rising slopes of the Kaibab Plateau, and powerful springs would have been released, and they would have flowed for centuries, which have been one of the water sources for the folks in the Nankoweap Canyon. There would have been natural springs as this water coming out of the aquifers was flowing, and then eventually it would have shut off, and any civilizations in the area would have left. Marble Canyon acts as a gutter, and it channels and intensifies the southern flow. And then, of course, combined cascading water from Grand and Hopi Lake erode 216 miles of what will be the Grand Canyon through the Colorado Plateau. As sediments picked up at the flow, it adds to the erosive power of this particular area, and then more energy is provided via the release of subsurface water. So now you've got this slurry of sand, of pulverized rock, rushing across soft sedimentary layers, eroding very, very quickly. And then, of course, 800 cubic miles of sediment are removed, forming the Grand Canyon. So there's your elevation changes. The Kaibab limestone in the north rim is pushed up because of all the released pressure, and the Colorado River is at the bottom. It's pretty, from a scale perspective, it's pretty cool. So I have some other information on a couple of other canyons, but I think we've covered all of the major material. So I guess we'll wrap up with this. Marble Canyon, Grand Canyon, all of that would have been formed by a massive erosion event. And the Grand Canyon, as it was formed by the merging waters of Grand and Hopi Lakes, that water would have released it. The water would have stripped away all of that particular, all the 10,000 square miles, all of that sediment, and it actually would have ended up somewhere near the Baja Peninsula. It's pretty interesting how far that all of that sand or all that sediment ended up. So today, the basin that held Grand Lake is drained by the Colorado River and several of its tributaries. The basin that held Hopi Lake is drained by the Little Colorado River. So both basins were once filled with silica-rich water that quickly escaped. And of course, there are many pieces of supporting evidence, things like mesas, buttes, spires, mounds, petrified forests, extreme meandering rivers, side canyons, hundreds of huge pits excavated by powerful erupting springs. All of these things can be explained by one massive erosion event. You don't see them so much on Zimmerman Trail, but out in Four Dances again, if you look at the sides of the sandstone, you'll see these, like, and you'll see them when you're walking around any kind of sandstone, and especially in this area, they're like these bowls that have just been eroded out. It's not as if air was trapped in them. They were caused by massive amounts of water traveling through the area, eroding, and then getting caught in essentially a little torrential turbidation, where the water would sit there and spin and spin out these little layers. And you can see that all over the place around the Grand Canyon. So all of this has been a very brief examination of the explanation of the origin of the marble in the Grand Canyon as it's described in relationship to the hydroplate theory. So I guess I want to reiterate, and I'll finish out my portion with this, that this has only been an introduction. I mean, this class, when I normally do it, it takes a year to get through all the material. We've gotten through a tremendous amount of information in only a few weeks. And the whole idea behind this is to get you to look into it a little bit more, to get you to think about it a little bit more. And maybe you're not interested in all of the things of the Grand Canyon. Maybe you're not all that interested in the geologic aspect of it. But there are many other components to the flood, to the hydroplate theory, that help explain why we see what we do today. So, any closing comments, questions? All right. Thank you for your time, and I'm done. So whoever's up next, here's your warning.